welcome everybody. I'm sorry this is such a bad time, but I'm really pleased that we have here, we're very, very lucky to have Javier Solana with us. As all of you know, Javier Solana was he was Foreign Minister of Spain. He was the High Representative for Foreign and Common and Security Policy of the European Union at a very critical time. And my view is that he really shaped the character of foreign policy in an important way, because that was the moment that Blair and Mitterrand decided it was time to have a security policy. And he was there at a key moment and had an incredible influence. And before that, he was Secretary General of NATO. So he has an enormous experience. So we're really privileged to have him come and talk about the European Union and the global context. And we also are very lucky because we have Tony Giddens, our former director, and those were the golden years of LSE, who's just written a book about the European Union, and so it's great to have him, and in fact, who introduced me to Javier Solana when you came, when Tony was the director. So we'll start with Dr. Solana and then go on to Tony Giddens.
Thank you very much. I'm trying to be your clap. Don't worry. We came late, so please, let's get into business. I'm sorry, it's my fault that we came late, but I am just coming to the airport. It was a traffic jam. Okay, well, I will like to start by saying that the reason to be here with you and to be here with my friends is because we have done the work and a book on the Europe and Europe consequences of whatever may happen, which is part of a Jean Monnet project. And I will not mention exactly what is part of the book and what is what I'm going to say out of the book, because so many things are happening that I think it's better to go into the questions of the day as much as possible. So I will start with the following. If we go back to 2008, we had the beginning of an important economic crisis. And during the period of the crisis, the global economy was maintained really at recent growth because of the emerging countries. America was not, the growth was almost zero, the European growth was almost zero. And therefore, we had the possibility of having the economy, the world economic growth going up. Was due to the emerging countries, and in particular, a great percentage of that, as you remember, is China. Now, what has happened today? In the European Union, during the crisis, we suffered a lot, and we still have not completely get out of the crisis. In any case, we have not resolved the consequences of the crisis. We have, in most of the countries, high unemployment. We have in most of the countries still the budget, the fiscal deficits up. So we have not been able to handle still the outcome of this crisis. The United States is going better. Your own country is doing better. But in the Central Europe and the southern part of Europe, still we have a lot to do. And when we began to see a little bit the light, something came that we didn't expect it, at least we didn't expect it in the manner it has produced, which is that emerging countries, instead of keeping up the economy going, the global economy going, China has begun to decline their growth. And when the engine of the global economy starts to decline the level of growth that it used to have, remember 30 years around 10%, and now it will reach, they reach 6%, it will be very lucky. So it's a big change. That is a big change that has repercussions everywhere. And it has repercussions in the global economy, of course, but it has repercussions in Europe also. And therefore, the data that's been provided by the IMF yesterday, or the day before yesterday, begin to say that Europe is going to slow in the growth, and the global economy is going to slow in the growth. So the only thing which is different is that the United States today is a little bit more dynamic in growth, but really the rest of the world, the emerging countries, have lowered their growth, and we, the Europeans, we have not begun. The beginning that we expected to see is not taking off with the speed and the depth that we hope to do. So this is the problem that we have. And the consequences for Europe are not very good. I think I'd like to say two things. The relationship between the elites of Europe and the people of Europe is becoming in every country to be very tense. I would say tense is probably not, is not the best word, but it's not a comfortable situation. I think that the people are beginning to think that the European Union is not what we expected, or they expected to be, to have when they were in the, when being in the European Union, that the hope for the younger generation is not very much, etc., etc. You know, this is linked to unemployment, salaries are not going up, and that is for a long period of time, because this is not a year or 2 years, this really already is since 2008. So that, it poses us in a very complicated situation to the Europeans. I'm very much pro-European, as you can imagine. I devoted 15 years of my life to the European Union. The problem that I see is that if the economy doesn't move up, if there's no growth in Europe, it will be very difficult to recuperate the sentiment that Europe is a solution of the problems, and therefore to have the people, in particular the younger generations, sentimentally and also intellectually, more pro-Europeans, understanding what is the sense of being European. And but this is very different. This is the circle that cannot, you don't know how to, where to cut the nut. Because if you want to grow, you have to do reforms, some reforms, and that detaches you from the people. But if you don't grow, you will detach the people from the leadership, also from political parties, classical political parties, etc. And this is really a very difficult situation. But my point is that we need very rapidly to get a sentiment or sense that things are going to get better, really, not only in the, rhetorically, but real. If we don't have that, we would not have the recuperation of the pro-European sentiment in the new generations, and therefore we would not be able to do the transformation that have to be done to continue growing. So this is the problem which I think we find. And this is a very difficult thing to resolve, and this is coming in just about every country. Movements which didn't exist before. I talk about my own country, for instance, we had two or three parties that didn't exist. The relationship between those two parties or three parties with power is much different than the classical powers. And that is because of the crisis in which we have been. That's been political, well, it's been economic in principle, but the consequences are very deeply political. Now, the second thing I would like to say is that this distrust is coupled with other problems that we have in the European Union. And we have in the European Union problems, which is impossible not to mention, which are linked to the situation in our surroundings, which you could look at them as foreign policy problems, but foreign policy problems, they have a very profound domestic consequences. And I'm going to talk to two, and say a word about the Middle East and the Mediterranean, in which the lack of action in Europe, in a way, has as a consequence of the situation, the suffering of breaking countries, etc. But it has a third consequence, which is the number of refugees. The number of refugees which are coming here, and we have added to the problems that we had that I mentioned before, this problem, how do we handle the refugee crisis? So therefore, let me point to this and underline this. It's an external problem that becomes an internal problem. Therefore, I would like to repeat that, because I think that this is going to happen in many other manifestations. The difference between external problems and internal problems nowadays is not that neat, it's a continuum. and you are not intelligent to see how we handle the continuum, you probably will not be able to resolve the problems that we have. Now, look at it on the other side, look at the question which is going on in the other border of the European Union, the East border, which is the situation in Ukraine, Russia, etc. Again, it's something that started as an external problem. It has become now a European problem, an eternal a domestic problem. And the consequences of these things is the following, that we begin to have a new layer of fragmentation in Europe that we thought they would never would be back. So we have a sort of divided line in economics, north and south, so Germany, France, Italy, Spain, Portugal, Greece, etc., and then the northern countries. It's a sort of difference there, a dividing line there, but it's very soft, that line. But the other line which is coming is a line that divides the East and the West. And I'm coming from Poland, and I spent 3 days in Poland. And what I begin to see in Poland is a little bit of what we have seen already at its worst manifestation in Hungary. And if you go from Poland to Hungary to Slovakia, and from Slovakia to Baltic countries, you begin to see a sentiment that the two things together, the relation with Russia, which are different, they sense the problem of Russia in a different manner than we sense the problem of Russia. And of course, they do find the question of refugees in a completely different manner than we see it. And what I'm afraid of is that if we don't do the appropriate pedagogy, we will have a potential fragmentation of the European Union through this, apart from the economic line, from this is worse line, which I don't want to be materialized. Why do I say that? I'd like to underline as much as I can. Because we have elections the 20th of October. We are going to have elections in Poland. And the figures that I have seen and the sentiment in the country is that Kaczynski, the brother of the other the one who was president of Poland, you remember his name, which was killed in an accident in a plane, which is the most conservative and nationalistic German, Poland, that I have lived through the late beginning of the 21st century, they may come back in a much more radical manner. And therefore, if we begin to have that, I'm afraid that this Poland, I mean, what you used to be, what we used to call the Visegrad countries, and we forgot to call it that because one day were part of the European Union and NATO was not much fun in being called Visegrad, they want to be called again Visegrad and had a common policies on question of refugees. You have seen that they have not voted with a majority in the refugees question, and that is something that it worries me very much. Now, again, all this or part of this was brought by a crisis which is external, which is the Middle East, which is external, Syria, and Russia, which is in a way external. But these two external crises are entering into the European Union, the borders of the European Union, and create an added problem to the European Union of today. Now, let me just to see you talking about the future, what is what we are going to see in 2006, 2007? We're going to see in 2006 elections in Poland, elections in Spain, December, and in 2007 we are going to see a referendum here, elections in Germany, elections in France, and elections in the Netherlands. So whatever we have in these 2 years is going to be absolutely fundamental for the Europe of the future. And one of the most important things will be the referendum in your country. But the elections in Germany and in France, in particular in France, in Germany very likely it will continue the chancellor, but in France it really will be very difficult to bet what is going to happen. So I think I took my time, but I'd like to to say a couple of things about Syria, because I'm not happy how things are going, and I don't think we are doing the things appropriately. And I think we should have gotten much more engaged to find peace in Syria. Now, when we finished the agreement between Iran and the nuclear Iran with the P5+1 or the E3+3, I think it was a moment in which something should have been done very rapidly to recreate a sentiment that from that agreement something could have been done in Syria. Well, that was not done. And in the meantime, we had the big refugees coming to here right after that, practically. And those are, to tell you the truth, those are refugees that are coming from Syria, but not only from Syria. They are coming from Turkey, they are coming from Jordan, they are coming from the countries that in the first place took millions of them. And therefore, Turkey, which has been a problem for us for many reasons, it should have been a solution, but it continues to be a problem for us. It's going to be a problem also today on the questions related to refugees. So, to see the picture broader, this is what is one of the reasons why I think that external and internal policies are beginning to be a continuum, and it will be very difficult to solve it properly without a lot of intelligence, a lot of common sense, and a lot of dedication. And here I come to the last thing that I would like to say, that I don't see the dedication, the passion, the enthusiasm of the leaders of the European Union to tackle the problems of today. So I have many, many things to say again, but I will say it in the dialogue afterwards. Thank you very much.
Thank you very, very much, Javier. And, you know, I think you said several things that are really important about the internal impact of external and vice versa, and the dangers of these authoritarian tendencies in Eastern Europe, and finally, how we really have to focus on Syria. And people have not focused on Syria for the last 4 years. And whether they're going to now, I don't know, but somehow they're going to have to. And then maybe Tony's going to answer some of these questions for us.
Oh, yeah.
So I'll turn to Tony.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. Cheer up a bit. Everyone looks very gloomy in this audience. As a former director of the LSE, I'd like to add my welcome to Javier. It's just great of him to come back, and he's been a very strong supporter of the school, frequently been involved with the school. Everyone here will know that Javier has had a stellar career, you know, in the practical world, not just as in my case, more in the intellectual world. And it's really wonderful that you've decided to come. So I hope we'll have at least a lively discussion after I've finished. I'd also recommend to everybody the Asadi volume, which Javier was speaking from, which is called The Global Context. Esade is E-S-A-D-E. And you're the head of this organization now, aren't you? So that's Javier's new role. What I like about the Esade book and what Javier has to say is that it breaks away from insularity. As someone who's done a lot of work on the European Union myself over the past 4 or 5 years, it seems to me a lot of the debates about Europe, for understandable reasons, are pretty insular. They focus on European issues as though these were simply determined by the travails of the European Union. Of course, in some substantial part, they are. But they have to, in my view, they have to be understood. And indeed, what everyone here is doing, what I'm doing in the future, we all have to try to analyze out the enormous global transformations and shocks that are occurring. And we have to integrate those with our understanding of the stresses and strains in Europe. Here, I suppose, I support the main thread of Javier's talk. And we can't understand, as it were, the one without the other. We must see what is generic and what is specific to Europe if we're going to get a proper view of what the future of the European Union might be. I think one of the things we're learning in the social sciences and in politics is that the 21st century is going to look very different from the closing years of the 20th century and indeed the first few years of this century, the first 5 or so, 6 years of this century. And we have to analyse things out. I think we're only in the beginning because we just don't understand fully some of the transformations which are affecting your lives, affecting all of our lives, individually as well as structurally. Let me just mention several quickly. I mean, this is a time of huge uncertainty, I'm emphasising, in global society. So reading the future is probably more difficult than ever has been for a long time. I mentioned three things quickly. One, the slowdown in the BRICS. The slowdown in the BRICS is deeply structural, I think, and deeply consequential for the world economy. A good deal of apparent economic growth of the past 30 years was fueled simply by the rise of China as an exporting country. China has deep, deep problems now, I think, very deep structural problems. Even if it manages to resolve those, it's still going to turn to internal demand. So the kind of export-driven model on which, for example, a lot of German manufacturing, not to mention Volkswagen, of course, a lot of German manufacturing was based. So, you know, all the BRICS are in trouble, actually, with the partial exception of India. Russia, obviously, Brazil in pretty deep trouble, South Africa, unfortunately, going nowhere. This is a very different world from 25 years ago. Second, I think, I'm not sure whether economists sitting here will agree with me, that we're coming to the end of the period when it makes sense to treat the world as like a gigantic marketplace in which everything can be bought and sold, and which in some sense supposedly will produce world order as well as prosperity. It's certainly contributed to prosperity, but it's proved pretty dislocating in terms of order across the world. And that's why we're seeing these schisms and divisions in so many parts of the world. This is a fractured world we're looking at here, I think. The main trouble for me as a social scientist is that although this paradigm to me has become substantially exhausted, there is no adequate replacement in sight. But I do think when you look at Jeremy Corbyn, you look at Bernie Sanders in the US, look at populist movements around the world, this is a kind of diffuse protest against the inadequacies of looking at the world in that way, which are manifesting themselves in people's own lives, in poverty, not just in the kind of fracturing of global society. Third, and to me really crucial, there are absolutely sweeping processes of technological change such as no one has ever experienced before, in my view, in human history. I mean by these the digital revolution. I spent the last 2 years of my life sort of concentrating on the digital revolution. I don't think there's been any period of technological change as global, as immediate, as consequential, and we're only in the early years of this. We don't know what its consequences will be. There are going to be deep consequences for the economy, but many other areas as well. I just offer you two quick examples en passant. You look at Islamic State, which is a theocratic organization seemingly based on hatred of women going back to the Middle Ages, but it's using cutting-edge digital technology to promote itself. It's kind of single-handedly invented the global use of beheading as an instrument of global terror, not just local terror. And IS has also got a lot of computer people working for it and organizing what it does on the battlefield as well. Second example, the migrants coming through Eastern Europe are not migrants as in the past, or many of them aren't. They're using their iPhones to plot a path. So are the ones coming from Afghanistan, or let's say smartphones. They're using GPS. The smugglers advertise, like travel agents do, you know, on the internet. This is 21st century migration, and ISIS is 21st century terrorism, I think. In the 21st century migration, no one is outside, so you can't just close off your border and suppose that people will not know what's going on inside. Everybody knows what's happening more or less everywhere for the first time ever. This is, I think, affecting all of our lives. So these, to me, are the backdrop you have to fold into any analysis of what's going on in the EU. Briefly, I won't detail this because it's so well known. You know, the EU is passing through one of the most troubled times of its history. We all know what's involved: the unresolved crisis of the euro, a newly belligerent Russia on its eastern side, catastrophe in Syria and Libya, a UK referendum looming, in which I think the outcome is now deeply uncertain. This is a pretty formidable cluster of problems, and Javier and the others in the book at least indicate some way in which we might come to terms with them. And I would stress the dangers are very real of this situation in Europe. I was just rereading the work of Margaret McMillan. I don't know if anyone else follows her. She's the warden of St. Anthony's College in Oxford, very famous historian, who writes about the interwar period in Europe. And she draws these, you know, somewhat frightening parallels between what happened then and what's happening now. And she says, we're all complacent that it could never happen again. But we mustn't be, I think. After all, in Syria, we've now got one nuclear organization, Russia, confronting NATO in probably a more direct way than was the case in Ukraine. However, although it's easy to point to the dangers, I'd like to conclude by pointing to the opportunities, because I think the world we're moving into is what I would define as a high opportunity, high risk society and economy. The risks are huge, but so are the opportunities. And I think this applies in Europe, and I'd just like to mention three areas where you could, I think, should point to the strengths of Europe. First, the EU is still far and away the biggest economy in the world, which gives it enormous economic weight compared even to the United States. And this is still a fundamental aspect, really, of the European Union, whatever its economic travails. I don't have time to elaborate on that. Second, the euro crisis obviously is far from having been resolved, but at least it has been moderately successfully stabilized, which is not what many writers were expecting in the years 2010 to 11. As we speak, Mrs. Merkel and François Hollande are addressing European Parliament, supposedly putting together a joint program between France and Germany. They've seemingly developed a common position on the future of the Eurozone. If this is true, it would be fundamentally important. We don't know, I think, whether it's true, but the main problem with the Eurozone is Germany's, don't want to blame a single country, insistence that there shouldn't be mutuality, that is, there shouldn't be fiscal stabilizing mechanisms. But for a stable monetary economy, you must have such mechanisms. According to reports about what Mrs. Merkel now think, she seems prepared to accept this. If that were so, it would be a pretty crucial point of departure. Third, finally, the US has dominated the digital revolution, but I don't see why the EU shouldn't dominate the next phase of that revolution. The EU can muster probably greater scientific and economic resources to pull ahead in the next few years if it gets its act right. And I mention only one example of that, which most people here will know, the extraordinary story of the Rosetta spacecraft, which, you know, has been in space for 10 years, has covered hundreds of millions of miles, has circled the sun and the moon in order to gain trajectory. It reached this comet, what's it called, 67P, you know, infinitely far from the Earth. It sent down a robot talking of digital revolution. Well, all this is only possible because of the digital revolution, right? The robot landed on the comet, quite unbelievable achievement, and then being the European Union, the battery ran out. Well, there's always something that goes wrong, but the battery is being recharged as it gets close to the sun. See, I think, you know, if it's possible to get structural reforms in Europe, it would help to heal some of the divisions. But, it, you know, for better or for worse, Germany has a rather key role in this, and it will depend on a relaxation of the so-called Ordnungsliberalismus that German policy has been based on. Finally, I think, you know, to deal with this world, this fractured, uncertain world, you know, this extraordinary combination of opportunity and danger, we're going to need new intellectual resources, new intellectual framework, as I mentioned earlier, and I would like to see the London School of Economics in the forefront of pioneering this and doing what it's done at other stages in the evolution of our society, politically and intellectually.
Thank you. Well, maybe this is an opportunity to start developing this intellectual framework.
Years ahead, it will be written down in history books. I was here.
Yeah, exactly. And what I wanted to add to your various measures, I was really surprised, Tony, I mean, it was wonderful everything you said, that you didn't mention climate change because it's your one of your big issues. And the reason I say that is that I think if we're going to find a new paradigm for Europe, it's got to be...
Well, it's not just for Europe, it's for the whole swathe. Yeah.
No, but I actually think that, well, for the whole world, I agree. But I think, in part, you know, most people feel Europe is either finished or it is a potential model. And it's a potential model in the sense, for instance, you mentioned the Rosetta spacecraft. But I think where Europe is really going to pioneer technology is in things like recycling, in things like energy efficiency, and the model of a sort of green, multilateralist, new type of set of institutions, that's the model for the next phase of development. That is, you know, the marriage of IT and green seems to me what the new paradigm has to be about. But having said that, I want to open the floor to discussion, and I also want to hear more, but whether people want to ask questions before, I'd like to hear more from Javier about what he thinks we should be doing and what EU should be doing on Syria and Libya. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Would you say who you are when you speak?
And a microphone, right? Mm-hmm.
There is a microphone. Do you want it?
Well, it's better for people at the back, I think.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. So Europe has always developed in crises, right? Second World War and so on. And would we need maybe actually a bigger crisis at the moment so that the political leaders wouldn't be... so complacent as they are and thinking that we still have time to act and don't really act actually in the end and just do half solutions. So that's my first question. Would we need maybe a more striking crisis where everybody would realize we need a solution? And the second question would be concerning the Balkans. The integration of the Balkans has stalled recently. What would be your suggestion to re-energize this integration of the Balkans? Thank you.
I'll let Javier come in now, and then we can collect more questions.
Okay, so thank you very much. I would like to comment on some of the issues that you have brought. I'm sorry, Tony, you have, but I mean, I will do it later. Now, going to your own, two-point question. I mean, I don't think that we need a deeper crisis. I mean, the crisis of this time has been really dramatic, economically, but also, as I tried to mention, politically. We have problems in our neighborhood that we never expected to have on this depth, and the East, which we didn't expect to have such a dramatic situation vis-à-vis Russia. We had some problems, but never thought that something like that would be with us in such a short period of time. Remember that we celebrated 2 days ago the 25th year of the reunification of Germany. That means of the end of the Cold War. And 25 years is nothing. But we have gone back to prior to 25 years ago, in a sense, with the tensions at the east of that time, in a very short period of time. So I don't think we need, if we don't wake up today, I think, I don't want to sound pessimistic, but a bigger crisis than this one is very difficult that will come again. Let's hope they will not come again. If we don't do it now, I don't know when. I really insist on that. On the Balkans, I think that the process of enlargement of the Balkans has started already. Croatia is part of the European Union already. Serbia and Kosovo, there was a big problem, the tension between the two. This is reducing the tension, and once this is reduced, Serbia will be able to move on, but faster. We still have the question of Macedonia, which is a big problem. But it's a problem which is also internal. It's not Macedonian only, but it's European, because Greece for the moment has not recognized the name, and that stops the process of... Now, I think that this is going to continue at a pace which is not be a speed of light, but it will be a speed of sound, at least. No? It will be at a speed that it will be commensurate what had happened from the other countries, or the so-called Visegrad countries, that they were much better prepared, and it was shorter, but it will continue. That's Croatia is a big example. If we didn't have today Croatia in, I would be my question or my answer would be maybe a little bit different. But having Croatia in, the door is open, and I don't think it's going to be closed.
Are you going to add about Syria and...
Oh, sorry. Yeah, on Syria, I can speak for hours.
We want you to, I think.
Let me be very, very schematic, but very frank what I think about Syria and about the solution, not about the causes and all that we know it. I think that we knew from the moment in which Russia abstained in the Security Council in the case of Libya, we knew that it was a very important signal. And the signal was, it was not only a signal, it was spelled out in a conversation, and I was part of that conversation, that if the Western world, NATO, stepped out beyond what resolution was accepted, for them will be the end of an agreement between the P5. And it's true. Since then, no UN Security Council resolution has been accepted. So we are with the United Nations Security Council stalled. Nothing has moved. Now, that is a big, big thing. So Syria came with a veto. And since the veto was there, Syria was a problem from the very beginning. And we didn't know how to handle, they didn't know how to handle, it was not there. It was very difficult to handle from that's the starting point of veto. And it was the beginning of having on Syria the territory in which a bigger war was being fought. One is the war of Sunni versus Shia. Hezbollah was there, Iran was there. At that time, still the Iran nuclear question was not resolved. Therefore, it was much difficult to deal with Iran. Turkey had a tremendous problem with Syria, and we are seeing today what is going on. Now, and we let the whole thing continue, and for our shame, I would say, we did not put much energy, much determination until we saw the refugees coming. So it's really a very, not a good use of our time and our capacity and our... Well, doing things. Now, today, with the Iranian thing resolved, I would say that the European Union should put on the table a meeting very rapidly of the, if not the same people that did the Iranian agreement, something very similar. So a European Union plus the P5, the three countries which are the P5, United States, Russia, UK, France, Germany, and the European Union represented by the institution, and try to get what is the most difficult thing to get, in agreement at what is the end of Assad. What are we going to do with Assad? How much are we going to be able to handle Assad? How are we going to solve? Now, we know with the spirit that we have that it's impossible to try to construct a new state if you don't want to accept anything of the old state. It was a failure in Iraq, it was a failure in Libya, so I don't think we should fall on that anymore. So parts of the state of Assad, some of the, what Assad represents, will have to be in the process. Now the question is to get an agreement when that the process is over and Assad has to step down. And that, in order to get an agreement on that, you need Russia. Russia is very important for them, Assad. They don't want to have another regime change, which is how they call it in Syria. But that thing is not impossible. I think today is a non-explicit agreement, with the exception of France and maybe Russia at the very end, that Assad has to be part of the process, but not part of the final solution. Okay? It will, a democratic, at the end of the game, Assad will not be the president of the new Syria, let's put it that way. But it's necessary to have Assad or somebody representing these people, the Alawites, in the process. And if we could do that agreement, and I think with the P5 an agreement, then the second phase is to sit on the table, the Turks, the Egyptians don't want to be on the table, so it's not necessary, the Saudis, and the Iranians. But if we have already the frame about what is going to be at the end, it will not be impossible to get that that move with determination, with force, and not having a meeting today like it was done the last part of the Iran agreement. Day and night, hours and hours and hours, tenacity on the diplomacy. The Mistura, the envoy of the Secretary General of the United Nations, has this, these things more or less on the tip of her fingers, but he has no the authority to convene that meeting, so that has to be done by others. Now, a question about Turkey. Turkey is going to be, for us, a very tricky country to handle, because we are seeing that they don't want to see Assad at all. But they are going to have to repeat the elections. It will be in October. And you remember that the elections were lost because the Kurds obtained 10% of the vote. And that 10% of the vote was what prevents Erdogan to have the absolute majority. Now, they got an agreement with the Americans to say, well, I let you my airport where you can fly to bomb ISIS, and I will join the coalition. But as you have seen, the coalition was not joined, and what it really did is bombarded the PKK and creating or breaking an agreement that for some years ago already was between the Erdogan and the Kurds. So the Kurds will not be voting probably, and Erdogan will be the supreme leader, and he will change the constitution, and we will have a country there very complicated. That's my sentiment that that may happen. We have to be prepared for that. But I think that our energy has to be concentrated of a group of people in the European Union to resolve the crisis, which is the war. If not, we will be having refugees and refugees and refugees with non-stop, because there are 2 million around. You know, Syria today, Syria when it started, the war started with 22 million of people. Mary, do you remember 22? Now they are 11. The rest are or displaced, or internally or externally, or killed. So it's a dramatic situation. And so there are about 20 million around, or 10 million people around the world that eventually will, if the war doesn't stop, it will be coming closer and closer and closer to us. So our common sense should mobilize to try to stop this war. I mean, the Americans have the people very far, and they don't have this problem at the level that we have it.
Quick comment?
Yeah, I'm going to make a quick comment. Go on, you make
I was just going to say that we have to deal in a sophisticated way with Russia. Now that Russia has got a new role in Syria, this is deeply, deeply dangerous. And bear in mind the connection between Libya, Ukraine and Syria in Russian eyes, because Russia felt almost humiliated, having supported the conclusion of the United Nations that you could have a protective zone in Libya, and then NATO just went on and produced regime change. The consequences of that have been very, very deep, I think. And we've got the reverse situation in a way happening in Syria. And if we don't get, I don't see why NATO couldn't make a bit of conciliatory gesture, because they got things wrong in Libya after all. It's just a disaster what happened in Libya. But that connection is there, and what the Russians do is so critical now that somehow the relationship between Russia and NATO needs to be healed. It could be worsened, obviously.
I agree with you, and I agree with Javier, but I just wanted to say something about the contents of what might be the talks, because actually we have had at least two Security Council resolutions on Syria. One was an agreement on humanitarian access. The other was the Chemical Weapons Convention, and more recently the agreement to investigate who was responsible. So it seems to me that the possibility for discussion should be not, as you say, on the removal of Assad, but on various humanitarian issues, such as stopping the use of barrel bombs. And similarly with Turkey, actually. I mean, we've just completed for DFID a big study of the Syrian war economy. And one of the most important factors in fueling the war economy is the free border with Turkey, where there are extremist groups that are gaining huge amounts of money from extorting whoever crosses, whereas the Jordanian border, for example, is properly controlled. And if Turkey controlled that border, that in itself would lead to some dampening down of the war economy and the sources of finance of the extremist groups. And there are all sorts of other concrete suggestions that could actually change the situation on the ground and make possible some kind of an agreement. It's what you and I are calling hybrid peace. Let's open the floor again.
You're right, but I think it's it's the big powers that are really going to take these decisions.
I disagree with
you, actually. It's not going to be the United Nations, because it has no direct power.
I disagree with you, actually. I think.
Well, I hope I'm wrong, but I don't think
so. The big powers, I think.
We need some disagreements, because too much agreement on this panel anyway. So.
I think that the big powers are constantly manipulated by people on the ground. They're thinking that they're making the agreements, but they get manipulated. And if you really want to end conflicts, you have to change things at a local level.
I'm not dispute that, but UN brokered agreements have very little consequence unless the key members of the Security Council in practice endorse them. And you saw that with barrel bombing, for example.
I'm not disagreeing with that.
Where Assad just ignored it.
I'm not disagreeing with that. I'm just suggesting a way forward on what should be the content of those agreements. In other words, not an agreement about a long-term political settlement, although we might get there eventually, but an agreement on relieving the worst suffering of people in particular areas on the ground.
That has to be done, but that...
So...
It's not enough.
Ali, again, say you are, even though I know.
Is it working? Can you hear me?
No.
One, two?
Yeah, that's okay.
Hello. Thank you. My name's Ali. I work for Mary at the London School of Economics. I do research about the conflict in Syria and in Iraq. I have a big question for the panel, which relates to the future of the EU. And the question is, what's the future of the nation state as an organizing entity in the 21st century? Okay, because the EU is still a collection of nation states. And we've been talking about ruptures and future ruptures and transformations, current and future. But what do we think about continuity? What kind of continuities will constrain us in seeking to move forward, seeking new ways of thinking about things? And I just wanted to make a comment about the Islamic State. If we want to understand it, the clue is in the second part of the name. It's not in the first. Everything they've been doing has been done by early phases of nation state building historically, and it's nothing new what they're doing. It's not particularly medieval. They use very high tech tools to do it, but chopping off heads, displacing difficult populations has been a very common feature of the nation state historically and contemporarily. Thank you.
Anybody else before I come back to the panel? Yes.
Kicked out at 3 or...
No, we've got 3:30.
Hello. I'm Julian, master student in EU politics from Switzerland with Polish roots, and that was a good topic because I worked as an intern in the Swiss Embassy in Warsaw from February to July. And it was very interesting to see those elections and to draw some conclusions from it. And my personal conclusion was this, that there's a vast electorate which is simply frustrated. And it isn't the rather old population from rural areas that doesn't believe in modern or liberal parties. It are very well-educated people from urban areas which voted for a nationalist party which actually links some social elements with nationalism. So a very radical mixture. So a simple question, what can be done to get those people back from believing, back from posting sometimes very radical material in social media? What can be done in concrete measures?
I think we'll take a round of answers and then I'll come to you because we've still got half an hour. So who wants to start? Tony, do you want to start on the nation state?
No, I'm
You've
happy to talk about nation
so
state.
So much about the nation state.
Yeah, but I mean, it's a very apposite question, actually.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I first started writing about globalization in, like, sort of turn of the century kind of time.
1990, really. Your book on...
Yeah, but anyway, let's say then. At that point, and for quite a while after, a whole flurry of books appeared called The End of the Nation State. I think there are about 4 books, actually, called The End of the Nation State. Famous book called The Borderless Economy, which did very well around the world. Some people were talking about sort of emergence of a new form of feudalism transcending the nation state. And I think you're quite right to say this has not happened. And therefore, this is a rather crucial feature, not just of the EU, but again, globally, I think. Not just the survival of the nation state, which is more problematic, but certainly feelings of affiliation to the nation, because there is not, I think, a stable system of nation states, as like Montserrat will know, coming from Catalonia, or, well, everyone comes from Catalonia, or us here in Scotland, you know, in the UK, where we've got sort of 4.5 nations, depending on how you define nations. So this is not a stable entity. And you have to ask what's going on here. Well, in the European Union, I think you have a convergence of factors which mean that many people have turned back to the nation as a kind of anchor in a world which, as I said, had become disturbingly hard, not just for intellectuals, but for people living their lives to fully understand and I think that's linked to the populism that was mentioned, which quite often goes along with a sort of nostalgic view of the nation state. Although, you know, I think it's complex because I think populism also has a heavy technological edge. So it's, populism is also linked to a demand for more direct democracy in the digital age, I think. So you get these odd fusions. And in the European Union, you know, these are crucial issues because they're clearly been going to affect whether or not you can do the things collectively that we need to do, because most of the issues that Javier outlined, they can really only be effectively dealt with by collaboration across Europe. More collaboration, not less. Yet, as we know, many electorates are feeling the opposite. So I don't think this sums it up properly. You know, it's a very complex entity, the nation state now. It's still pretty central to people's lives and to power, but it's not just the nation state as it was even 20 years ago, I think. And Javier's right to say you have, like, you know, global diasporas of many kinds in the digital age as well, which intersect with it. You have so many people living outside their states of origin, for example. Someone did this really good study of Filipino nannies. It's all the women who travel and all the men stay at home and do nothing. And the women raise like global families. It's quite amazing. They all keep in touch with digital technology. These are people with not much money at all. And they all still feel Filipino, but they're global at the same time. So this is a very good example of the complexities of this emerging world, I think, anyway. It certainly connects with the point that was made about the division between the cosmopolitans and the locals. And I think that's deeply connected with deindustrialization, actually, because I think we must look to reverse deindustrialization. I don't think we should just accept it as inevitable. That's destroyed many traditional communities, and the people in those communities feel deeply threatened. And, you know, you can't see where these forces are coming from. A very good example is Dagenham, you know, which I used to go to quite a lot in London. The Ford Motor Company was there. Someone took a decision in Detroit or somewhere to close it down. The whole community became almost, jobless overnight. Property values went down. Migrants moved in. The immigrants were then blamed for what was actually part of the structures of a much wider system. And I think this happens very commonly. So somehow we have to find a local politics of these things and operate on a national level, but also recognize that there is a crucial transnational level, which is how the world really is now. So it's really complicated. But I think the tenor of the question is correct. The nation state has not gone away, as many prominent thinkers thought 20 years ago it would by now.
But I don't think that a nation state is going to disappear. But it will be a nation state different than the one we have today. I mean, my country, France, any country in the European Union is different than a nation state. I don't have all the characteristics of a nation state. Budget is approved now by a semester that is in the European Union for a member of the European Eurozone. Schengen, the borders are not your borders, I mean, with the exception if you want to be out like you, but I am not out, so I don't need a passport to go to anywhere in Europe. So there are many things we're giving away. And let me, from my academic background, which is not political science, it's theoretical physics, let me think about a molecule. A molecule is two atoms that do get together and share something, the external electron. But when you go to that atom, to that molecule, you recognize perfectly the atom that composed the molecule. But the molecule acts completely different. Water, H2O. You know what H, an oxygen. And you separate them, they're gases. You put them together, it's liquid. And you can distinguish the three of them. But by sharing something very little, one electron, the last electron that they have, they change completely in nature. Now, I'm not going to go this very far, but there are 180 elements in nature, 160. Well, they're about the members of the United Nations. Nature has acted much more intelligently, putting things together and having less energy. When you have a molecule, you have less energy. So you are solid, or solid, and you can do things that separately you cannot do. Think about DNA. DNA is a molecule and produces life. No? Now, with this, I don't want to go stupidly going into dreams. But there are possibilities of, by sharing things, by sharing capabilities, or by sharing even sovereignty, you can do things much better. And that has been proven in the European Union in many cases. That doesn't mean that the nation state is going to disappear. Italy will continue to be Italy, and because they lose the lira, everybody knows that Rome is the capital of Italy. But you pay with euros, so you have lost your currency, which is an important identification. So I think that it's possible to find a mechanism that will allow to do things better by acting together and by sharing together sovereignty, part of your sovereignty. But I mean, it's difficult, but to go to the point, I don't think that the nation state is going to disappear. We will be always having Italy, but in Italy with less, without money, without currency, without judges, maybe, but they will speak Italian, and they have the beautiful culture, etc., etc., etc. I mean, there, I think, is the way in which I see the evolution of the concept of nation state. And I have two questions, or one, at least on Poland, that I would like to not to answer, because I agree with you. I don't see the... I think that Poland has done a fantastic work, a fantastic job, in the transition. The Poland of today, you compare Poland to Ukraine economically. In 1999, Ukraine was higher than Poland in GDP. Today, Poland has multiplied, I don't know by what factor, the GDP of Ukraine.
Nine times, actually.
Nine times, no? One has integrated into the European Union, the other no. And they have done the reform, they have done the accommodated economy, not only political, but economy. Now, I think that this particular, what is going on now, it has to do with the fact that they thought that everything was done. The election of the president, you refer to the election of the president. The election of the president has been really a stupid mistake. The candidate that was to be the incumbent went to sleep. Didn't do any. He thought that he was already elected, no? And he was defeated badly. And it's going to happen the same with the national election. The Kaczynskis are going to win. Not the Kaczynski, because he's not going to run, but it's a lady which is running on his behalf, which is going to win. And then you remember what it was, the Kaczynskis. This is Radio Maria. It's absolutely anti-Russian, absolutely anti-Germans, pretty much closer to all our friend in Hungary, the what it used to be, Tusk. I think Tusk probably should have stayed. Looking from today, maybe two should have stayed and run these elections. But, we asked to come into the European Union. But I talking to to somebody very important in Germany, asked the three problems: Brexit, and the elections in Poland. 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago.
Okay. I've got three questions, so we start with Masuma.
What time are we going to finish?
But we might finish a little bit before.
I thought we'd finish at three for some reason.
Hi, my name is Masuma Torfe. I'm on Mary's team doing research. Formerly, I was in Afghanistan as the UN Director of Communications. And I'm very mindful because of that, of the fact that Syria and IS are obviously a consequence of failure in Afghanistan and Iraq. And the fact that Russia has come into line right now, I mean, I hate to be agreeing with Mr. Putin, but that mess has left a situation that it looks as if we've actually invited Putin to come and do what he's doing right now. You know, anyone in his position might have done the same. But the point I wanted to make in connection with the EU is that in Afghanistan, I watched that in the meetings of the international community, how the European Union does have very good ideas for democratization, for good governance, for this and that, but it doesn't actually have the teeth to implement what it wants to do. It's always the Americans who have the upper hand for a very simple reason that they spend so much more money. I wanted to ask, why is it that the EU cannot be given more funds rather than different European countries spending separately, each for their own purposes and their own interests? Why doesn't this come in a whole lot that EU can spend and have more teeth in places like this so it can implement more democratization process?
Okay, we'll take three at once.
Yes, my name is Andreas Rodnoti. I'm also doing a master's in international relations at the school. Mr. Solana, you talk about re-emerging dividing lines, the Visegrad group, and their diverging views on Russia and the refugee crisis. And of course, it seems in a couple of days we'll see Polish and Czech and Slovak soldiers helping guard Hungary's border with Croatia. And you seem to imply that leadership is at least one of the conditions needed to overcome these divisions. But then, don't the divisions themselves, in fact, inhibit leadership? Who would you confer leadership on? Should old Europe lead new Europe? Should Brussels establishment lead the democratic peoples of Europe? Or is a consensus somehow possible, and how?
And Mary.
Mary Martin from LSE. Can I ask you both, you've both identified fracture and fragmentation as an emerging phenomenon of the New World. And this fracture is not just along perhaps nation-state lines, it's quite complex, it's cultural, it's social, it's political. How do we address it then? And this is sort of a devil's advocate question because I don't actually believe it myself, but faced with the potential of Grexit and Brexit, should we just let people go? Should we just accept that Europe is not a fixed, it's never been a fixed concept really, it's much more fluid than that, and therefore, you know, accommodate sort of fracture and fragmentation rather than fighting it.
Okay, I'll start with Javier and then.
Okay. Well, first was on the teeth. Well, I mean, you touched something that in which I've worked a lot and I'm working now. We're working now on what we may call a union of security and defense, monetary union, energy union, digital union, as it was said before by Tony, very important digital question, but why not to think about a security defense union? Now, we are working on that. The European Union 28, members of NATO, no, all together, without to be members of NATO, Sweden is not a member of NATO. We spend every year about 193,000 millions of euros, which I don't think are well spent. And again, if we were able to construct something which has to do with it in nation state also, because the military is very important, or the security forces are very important, but I think we should have an opportunity to start to think about that. When we are seeing the south or the east, the things that which we have to do if we want to really be meaningful, we need to have more teeth. And we cannot spend much more, we have to spend better, and we have to unify or integrate much more what we have. And we have to do it not only thinking about the military, because the war of today is not only military. And if it's true what I said before, the internal and external is a continuum, part of the Minister of Interior on the different states should be the budget maybe shared with the defense of the defense with the Minister of Interior. So it will be a completely different concept that we have to do with what is security today, the hard security and the soft security, how we can... And I think there's a possibility of doing that. For that, it's very important that the UK does not leave the European Union. But even without the UK, I think that the French and the Germans are thinking very seriously on that. And to tell you something very important for me, I was in the White House the other day talking about these things, and this was to be, for an American, was blasphemous to say these things, no? That the contribution to NATO was going to do by the European Union eventually, not tomorrow, but eventually. Today they take it, please do it, but do something, do it. There's not this negative attitude to duplication. This is over, this is over. So I agree completely with you, and I will send you the report that we have done on all that. Now, on your point, it's very difficult to explain in a few words what your question, which is very deep, well, is the essence of the how do you do at the same time integration and nation state, and what is the leader of a country? Well, now, talking the other day with people like Mario Monti and some other leaders of the ex-leaders of the European Union, we were thinking about to whom to blame. And I think today we should not blame to the institutions of Brussels. I don't think they are the responsible of whatever is not going right in the big picture. I think I would like to blame more the national leaders, the leaders of the nation states, because they really never consider the European Union as a really important issue in their agenda. It's impossible that they came out of the same meeting and give a press conference to everybody, to their constituency. And if you are somebody from another planet and listen to the eight, you will say, well, they have been in eight different meetings. Now, I think that the leaders of the important countries, at least, well, all the leaders, they don't have now the sentiment to talk about the European Union, to think about the European Union, like the leaders, some other leaders in some other times in the 90s, I think they were much more committed to the construction of the European Union from the responsibility not of the Commission or the Council, the Council, but then when they are at home also talking about that, having Europe as part of our everyday life and therefore talking to our fellow citizens of the European Union as our everyday life. Taxes, budgets, highways, infrastructure, education, all these things are more or less already on the European side. No? Erasmus, all these things. Okay, that is the second thing I would like to say. And I think it's very important to have leaders which, national leaders who think Europeanly, not only national.
Can I respond then? Because I think your question is really important, actually, because I think there's a big period of transition for thinking in the EU about its role in the wider world, because for a long time, the predominant view was that the EU was the vanguard of the future, that cooperation and peace were the way in which you deal with an interdependent world is converged with the literature on the end of the nation state, I think. And that was sort of formalized both in EU policy making and in the academic thinking, because there was the idea of the postmodern state, if you remember. The postmodern state was supposed to be where nation states were going, and they were more interested in cooperation, no longer interested in violence. Well, the world hasn't turned out like that at all, and what we've seen is the EU trying to make, which Javier's helped a lot, I have to say, an adjustment to this very different world. And it's been really difficult because, you know, there are two things I would mention. First of all, the old view of the EU kind of repressed the role of NATO and the Americans. You know, the EU fond of people, well, many leaders fond of criticizing the Americans. But, you know, they can't do anything in crisis situations without the Americans, as we saw in the Balkans and we see in Ukraine. So, you know, I think that was phony, really, that kind of dismissal of American power. And now the Europeans have to reconcile themselves to that. But then we're in a very difficult situation because since the old model has lapsed, you have this situation where everyone wants to have their cake and eat it. They want to be Europeans when it seems useful, and then they want to act like nation states, especially in foreign policy, I think. So you're in a situation where, again, the more powerful national leaders tend to determine EU policy acting along with the Americans. And, well, who brokered this peace in Ukraine, if it is peace? Well, Merkel and Hollande, who gave them the right to trot off to the Ukraine, you know, conduct peace in the name of not just the EU, but the world, as it were? So there's a lot more thinking to be done about that. On Brexit and Grexit, well, first of all, I think the terms are really stupid and they should be banned, Brexit and Grexit. I mean, these are big issues. You don't want to trivialize them by using those terms, I feel. I don't, you know, I think Brexit, actually, if you want to use it, is more likely than Grexit, even though a lot of people think the other way around. But the thing about Greece is the people want to stay in the European Union. And this is amazing, given the kind of oppression that's come with it. The majority of people want to stay in the Euro, want to stay in the European Union, in spite of all the things that happened, and I think are likely to do so, because I think at a certain point there will be some kind of disguised debt redemption, actually, for Greece, and there are strong geopolitical reasons why the Greeks want to stay in the EU. Of course, it could happen, but Brexit, on the other hand, if you want to use that term, I think has suddenly become really problematic. I mean, I'm a pro-European. I want the UK to stay in. If the UK leaves, it won't be the UK. It'll be Britain or England, because Scotland almost certainly will have enough of a referendum if that happens. You know, only a few months ago, the majority of people in surveys, those who wanted to stay in, were well ahead. Now it's more or less even marking in some of the latest polls. The reason, I think, is simply the unstable position of the rest of Europe that we're discussing here. And most people don't know a lot about the European Union. They're probably going to respond on the basis of feelings about immigration, as us three were discussing earlier. It might be affected by what's happening at a particular time, how that's perceived. Many citizens don't even make a distinction between refugees coming from the Middle East and EU migration. So this is suddenly really up in the air. If the UK did leave and is no longer the UK, I mean, there will be a stream of consequences across Europe, not least for Catalonia, I think, because if Scotland then became an independent country, if it was decided that Scotland could stay in the Euro in principle, or should stay, or should join the Euro in principle, you have knock-on consequences for many other nationalist groups, because, as I was saying, the nation state is here, but it's not stable. And, you know, any number of countries where you've got local nationalists who want to break away. So I think we should, in this country, fight very hard to keep the UK in the EU and keep the UK as the UK, as itself, a cosmopolitan group of nations, not one which itself subdivides at the same time as it cuts us off from the rest of Europe. But I think it's a very open issue at the moment, unpredictable, really.
Well, thank you, and I agree with you, and I'd like to say a couple of things. I mean, first of all, I couldn't agree more with Masuma about the need for teeth, but I don't think teeth is about aid. I actually think aid is really problematic. Most of the wars we're seeing are kleptocratic wars, and aid fuels the war economies.
The EU hasn't been very generous, has it?
Well, it has if you add up the individual nations. Yes, it has. So the problem is, and you know as well as I know, I mean, I think the real issue in Afghanistan was the failure to arrest warlords, many of whom were American citizens. And that happened because of the war on terror. And I think it's our going along with the war on terror and not carving out a distinctive position.
Well, Germany didn't go along. I mean, the whole of the EU didn't go along, at least the major aspects.
Well, in the context of Afghanistan and in the context of the places where the Europeans are working together with the Americans, the war on terror imperative takes over from the alternative imperative. And so the key issue, I think, is a political issue, and it goes back to Javier's point about leadership. And I wanted to say something about that. I think one of the problems of leadership is that politics is still national, and that politics has become almost a sort of sclerosis, inward-looking. The people who become leading politicians are former civil special advisors. There's no real politics in the country. And there's no real politics at European level. And as far as national politicians, Europe is just something that you take a position on according to what you think will run well in domestic. And they play the anti-European card when it suits them. So that seems to me the problem of lack of leadership. And the most hopeful thing, I think, is the new movements that are emerging, like Syriza, Podemos, the Corbyn phenomenon here. The problem is they're largely national. And it seems to me absolutely central that if we do want a kind of alternative politics, not only at home, but generally, we need an alternative politics at European level. And it's there that I think the key is. And so I think that's a really important development. And how that moves and how the connections are made is very important. I think
Shall we
come...
give the last word to Javier?
Yeah, let Javier...
I think you have finished very well. And well, I think that the I wouldn't say the Brexit, because it's not a good terminology, but let me tell you that the referendum in the United Kingdom is going to be a very, very important event, not only for your country, but for those who are Europeans like me, for Europe. I would like very much to see your country in the European Union and even more engaged than you are today. But let's see.
Well, we welcome you back throughout the referendum campaign.
Well, thank you very much for coming.